information is free.
The law?
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge,
we care.
Appear to border
and it shows.
The law?
The country.
You will remember nothing you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, it made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
Mystery is a source of leverage and power. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 244 from Media Monarchy. It's December 23rd, 2011. Last rites, Korean War, and a false dawn. Payroll predictions, netty plots, sob stories, and the work on Christmas news purge, plus pagan celebrations, solstice shrouds, an abuse scandal, updates on holy hexes, planets, patents, and manning up on cyberspace war, pecan thieves, salt babies, and the Fanta Santa soda on food world order, all that and so very much more on episode 244 for December 23rd, 2011. And this is MediaMonarchy.com.
A studio apartment in a dull part of Seattle. A strand of light suspended by a thumbtack in the drywall. The restaurants are closed, so are the record shops, the banks and bars and bartel drugs, and so's the half-price bookstore. But the movies are always open, and I always have to open. Repertory movie house where life is not so wonderful for 15 soggy patrons who have no better place to be, not to mention me. I'm working for a holiday wage. My family is two time zones away. I'm supposed to call them. My vodka and snow is melting. The alcohol isn't helping. Sometimes you have to work on Christmas. Sometimes you have to work on Christmas. Sometimes you gotta work. Sitting on the coffee table, yeah. Strangers and spit changers stand in line like poor relations at some kind of sad reunion, and I'm selling the tickets. They come in out of the weather for Christmas alone together. Sometimes you have to work on Christmas. Sometimes you have to work on Christmas. Sometimes you have to work on Christmas. I doubt I'll miss this.
Sometimes you have to work on Christmas. Sometimes. Title track from the EP from the late, great Harvey Danger. Sometimes you have to work on Christmas. Sometimes. But not this time for me. And I only heard that song recently. I've been a fan of the band for a while. And I love how it mentions movie theaters. And I used to work in one. It mentions Seattle. I'm here in Portland. My family's three time zones away, not two. And we're here at Christmas Eve, my friends. It's episode 244, December 23rd, 2011. And my name is James Evan Pilato, your host and webmaster of the site and show MediaMonarchy.com. Your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, cover-ups, so very much more. And there's so very much to go over this week. We are broadcasting live, as always, from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org. And, of course, a huge thanks to the stations that rebroadcast this show, especially those that do it live. ZeroPointRadio.com and RevereRadio.net. Huge thanks to them. All our archives are on radioforall.net. That's the audio only. And archive.org has audio, video, high quality, low quality, everything else. And if you just subscribe to feeds.feedburner.com/media monarchy, you won't miss almost a thing. So many things out there. And we'll go over them on this episode as we keep branching out and expanding the Media Monarchy Kingdom. A huge thanks, as always, to the community at tragedyandhope.com. And we are on FaceSpace, Twitter, Tube, Tumblr, Gmail, Skype, Instant Messenger, and more with Media Monarchy as your keyword or username. And a huge thanks in the past week to the donations from James in Ohio and Agnes in London. Your support helps keep Media Monarchy going and growing. And as we are here at the end of the year, if you have a little extra, please support Media Monarchy. Please support ZeroPointRadio.com. Please support Revere Radio, the Portland Radio Authority, Corbett Report, Tragedy and Hope, any independent, corporate-free alternative media outlet. It's never been easier. It's generally a button click away. But even if you don't have that set up, and all these things are posted on the flagship site at MediaMonarchy.com. We even have a P.O. Box, 12165 Portland, Oregon, 97212. And again, my friends, it's December 23rd, 2011, and as we look at the current news, House and Senate clear a payroll tax accord, payroll tax cut, jobless benefits extension passed Congress in special last-minute session. Bomb blasts hit two security facilities in Syrian capital. Turkish Prime Minister cites French genocide in Algeria. Netflix CEO's stock options slashed. More retailers pull formula after Missouri infant death. And Ron Paul talks 9/11, Iran, and cookbooks on his last tour stop before Christmas. All that plus Mitt Romney, Vaclav Havel, Vladimir Putin, Taylor Swift, and more are the top bubbling, trending stories on Google News right now, and we'll always keep that open to see what happens on a Friday morning. I mentioned so many things happening, and it's tough to keep all the plates spinning, especially as it approaches the holidays. But I was lucky enough to snag some time with Morgan Lesko of WikiWorldOrder.com. He's living in UC Davis, home of the pepper spray cop and so many other Occupy actions. But he was in Portland for a few days, and I grabbed him, brought him over here to the Portland Radio Authority studios, and we did a quick half-hour interview. That is now posted. And it won. Thanks to him for doing it. Two, his YouTube channel, as we joke in the interview, is the unlimited kind, whereas Media Monarchy YouTube has the 15-minute smackdown. So not only has he posted this interview in a video form, which is just a still of the album art I made, so it's nothing really to see, but again, if you can put it on YouTube and if you can get extra viewers that way, any way we can spread this kind of information, open source style, public domain, give it away. I don't own it, and neither do you. We're going to do it any which way we can. So not only is this half-hour interview posted up on youtube.com/wikiworldorder, just like it sounds, but he also put up last week's Food World Order appearance on Corbett Report Radio. I've probably mentioned it, but again, so many things start up. I don't like to bust out of the gate and say, yeah, I'm doing this thing, and I'm going to do it every week, and it's going to have all this stuff, because I like to, you know, test it out and see how the production style is going to go. But having said that, each Thursday night, and we've done three so far, and we did one last night, on the live versions of Corbett Report Radio, for the second half of the show, we're covering just food, health, environment news from foodworldorder.com. I've been shooting the video on my end, much like I do with the Bob Tuscan appearances. That's monthly. The Food World Order shows are going to be weekly. I've made one video so far, and again, thanks to Morgan Lesko of wikiworldorder.com for hosting that Food World Order video on his YouTube site. That's how it works. Huge thanks. So, speaking of James Corbett, our latest episode of A New World Next Week is now available. It's episode 96, Korean War, Manning Up, and Funding Terror. Now, of course, you can find previous episodes of The New World Next Week at newworldnextweek.com, which I recently remodeled. It's nice, it's simple, it's slick. I dig it. Episode 96 first gets into the changing face of Pyongyang, hereditary succession under close scrutiny of elite U.S. policymakers. That's right, Kim Jong-il is dead. Long live Kim Jong-un. And we will get into this story in just a few minutes with its main post on MediaMonarchy.com. An update from The Guardian: South Korean intelligence disputes circumstances of Kim Jong-il's death. And I think it's noteworthy. I don't want to toot a horn too much, because it wasn't really my prediction. It was from ZeroHedge.com. I just picked it out of a list and said, Last year's last episode of New World Next Week, the final segment, got into predictions for 2011. So I tweeted that out. The link is right there on the 2010 prediction made of, one, the ending of the Iraq War, two, Obama's continuing falling popularity, and three, that Kim Jong-il would die. We called it. NewWorldNextWeek.com. Story number two, Manning opts not to testify in WikiLeaks hearing, and related bits on CyberspaceWar.com and BoilingFrogsPost.com. Investigators show evidence of WikiLeaks link. And Sibel Edmonds on revisiting her silence on WikiLeaks. And again, that's on Boiling Frogs Post. Our third story, U.S. troops guarded terrorist camp in Iraq. That's right. State Department admits it. Guarding MEK. We create terror. That's what we do at the School of the Americas. We train terrorists. That's what we do with the Mujahideen that became Al-Qaeda, the database, the name created by Western intelligence for this group of Mujahideen fighters they had on a list. But related to this latest quote-unquote revelation, anti-Iran terrorist confession, Jundala leader Abdelmalek Reghi, R-I-G-I, and an update from CorbettReport.com, the Manas question, drugs, revolution, and terrorism on the road to Afghanistan. So I'll add the extra addendum to we create terror. But we also need drug money. That's a really important factor. So let's get into all the other latest from Harness Working Man in Alternative Media, CorbettReport.com, episode 213, Revisiting Psychopathy. It's been a while since Corporate Report last examined the topic of psychopathy, and that was episode 90, Our Leaders Are Psychopaths. And in the meantime, a number of articles, papers, documentaries, and books have emerged to shed more light on the issue. But as this growing understanding of psychopathy begins to shape the way we understand the global economic collapse and the moves toward political tyranny, do we run the risk of starting a new witch hunt? We also always post up all the latest related videos and audios from CorporateReport.com. U.S. troops deploying on Jordan-Syria border. Spotlight on Kazakhstan and geostrategy on the new Silk Road. NATO troops on Syrian border. James Corbett on Russia Today. End of Nations, Canada and the U.S. and the security perimeter. Those stories go all around the world, but you notice it's all about perimeters and borders and the bolstering of or the breaking down of said borders and perimeters. Also, latest interviews with Bob Chapman, Cynthia McKinney, Michelle Chosadovsky, Donna LaFrambois, and Rick Rozoff. All that and so much more from CorbettReport.com. And we shift over quickly to my man Clyde Lewis from right here in Portland, Oregon. He runs GroundZeroMedia.org. If you're a fan of Coast to Coast, if you're a fan of Red Ice Radio, you will dig it. Latest articles and episodes, Last Rites, Cytogenocide, Plausible Deniability, and the Final Solution, Gnome for the Holidays, Last Christmas, and Der Krampen, The Return of Satan's Claws. No behind-the-scenes videos from Clyde Lewis this week, and I've been meaning to get in touch with him, and we will and we shall in the new year to cover all the things going on in the world of the occult, inner and outer. So that is all from GroundZeroMedia.org, CorporateReport.com, WikiWorldOrder.com, and all the other related fantastic alternative media I'm proud enough and blessed enough to be associated with. So we'll begin with our lead single, Story. It's the one that had people asking me about it at work, and I know things are reaching that kind of mass level. Not to insult anybody I work with, they're all amazingly smart and interesting people. But I can tell when something is being pushed as part of the zeitgeist. And not to downplay this story either. But I knew when I had coworkers and people saying, so, what do you think about the death of Kim Jong-il? North Korea's longtime leader and cult of personality dead at the age of 69. We have related stories, and again, this is one of those stories that gets so large that I'm not going to be the one to provide you the massive overview of information. We'll just give you the bits to break it down and give you tons of links and tons of documentation for you to go and search out the stories on your own, as we implore on every other level. I mentioned James Corbett on Russia Today discussing Syria, but he was also on Russia Today discussing the North Korean situation, and we're going to get to that, but first let's get the broad overview. When the news was announced, at least on the West Coast, late Sunday night, that Kim Jong-il is dead.
North Korea's veteran leader Kim Jong-il has died at the age of 69. State media announced he passed away on Saturday after suffering a heart attack. Kim Jong-il's youngest son, Kim Jong-un, has reportedly been named his successor. Meanwhile, as the news broke, Pyongyang's long-standing enemy, South Korea, put its armed forces on high alert while the government has declared the situation an emergency. Kim Jong-il's body is lying in state in a mausoleum in the capital before a funeral service on December 28th. Until then, a period of mourning has been declared in the country. Anissa Nawe takes a look back at the life of a man who became a symbol of the reclusive state.
A mystery to the world. What now for North Korea with its leader Kim Jong-il gone? This massive military parade was held in 2008 to mark North Korea's 60th anniversary. General Kim Jong-il wasn't there to greet the crowd. Reports suggested he suffered a stroke. In 2003, reports claimed Kim Jong-il died of diabetes and had been replaced in public by stand-ins hired previously as a security measure. He never spoke to the media, had a profound fear of flying, and ate with special chopsticks which could detect poison. Rumors have surrounded the so-called supreme leader throughout his life, beginning with birth. According to one source, he was born in the Soviet Union in 1941 during his father's exile, while Kim Jong-il's official biography claims his birth was heralded by the appearance of a double rainbow.
Our people take pride in the fact that they are blessed with great leaders from generation to generation.
The leader of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea since 1994, he succeeded his father, Kim Il-sung, keeping Korea close to the world. Kim Jong-il was also named Supreme Commander of the People's Army, one of the largest in the world, with 1 million active troops and over 4 million reservists. It's believed enormous funds allocated to its military might ate up North Korea's resources needed to fight famine and other social problems. But Kim Jong-il and his regime tried to put on a different show when allowing the globe a glimpse inside.
Our father, the General Kim Jong-il, thank you so much.
After the Korean War, the demilitarized zone was drawn up, sending North and South Korea in two very different directions. Decades on, the North remains a closed communist state, the South a modern democracy and innovative success story. North Korea has caused global outrage in recent years, testing patience by carrying out underground nuclear tests and short-range missile launches, leading to U.S. and U.N. financial and military sanctions.
It is now not a matter of the United States and North Korea. It is really a matter of the region saying to North Korea that it has to change its behavior.
Russia has tried to be a mediator for peace on the peninsula by pushing for negotiations.
In the Asia-Pacific region, there's serious potential for conflict, and there's no alternative but to set up dialogue and improve understanding between the sides.
In 2010, new buzz blew up around the North with talk of the possible next leader. That's when Kim Jong-un became a four-star general and first moved into line to take over for his father. November saw tensions reach its highest point in decades after the North launched an artillery strike that left four dead. South Korea continued to hold large-scale war games with the U.S. and Japan and warned conflict would break out if another attack was launched. Now Kim Jong-un, a young and inexperienced leader, is at the helm and will either open the door or continue to keep it shut.
This railway station was built in 2002 with hopes of connecting Seoul and Pyongyang, but the North Korean regime backed out at the last minute, making this the last stop trains heading back into the south. Now, with Kim Jong-il's death, there's new hope that perhaps soon we could see a train heading in that direction, shedding light on the most secretive and reclusive country in the world. And he's now at RT Korea.
He's a mysterious person, I think by design. Mystery is a source of leverage and power. It's maintaining uncertainty, said Han S. Park, director of the Center for the Study of Global Issues at the University of Georgia and a frequent visitor to North Korea. That comes from CNN, and we have so many other links to Twitter feeds and Wikipedia and so many other things to help just flesh out this story. Young heir faces uncertain transition in North Korea from the New York Times. With the abrupt death of the North Korean leader, the fate of his isolated nuclear-armed regime has dropped into the hands of his youngest son, Kim Jong-un, who is such an unknown that the world did not even know for sure what he looked like until last year. But the biggest enigma may be whether the younger Kim will be able to hold on to his power in this last bastion of hardline communism, much less prevent its impoverished economy from collapsing. And from Reuters, North Korea's neighbors on alert, West hopes for opening. And even from Haaretz, Israel hopes death of North Korea leader will damage ties with Iran. The death of Kim Jong-il raises the possibility that the alliance between North Korea and Iran will flag, just as their third partner, Syria, is also weakening. Never miss an opportunity to exploit a crisis. Now, that clip mentioned the nature of his death. Now, whether he died Saturday or died 3 years ago, and we can relate it to the death of Osama bin Laden on May Day of this year, regardless of when it went down and how many doubles are in place, publicly they are being written out of the show. And we know that. We have our other related geopolitical and war horror updates, but let's get further into this story, again from Russia Today, with our friend James Corbett.
Well, with Korea preparing to take its first steps under new leadership, the world is waiting to see what the country's primary move will be. Joining me now is the editor of the Japan-based news website, CorbettReport.com, James Corbett. Mr. Corbett, many thanks for joining us here on RT. South Korean media is reporting that the North has just test-fired a ballistic missile. If that is true, what sort of message do you think is being sent here?
Well, if it's true that nature abhors a vacuum, it must be especially true when it comes to nuclear-armed states when we talk about global geopolitics. So this is obviously an extremely tense situation in a lot of ways, and I think any new regime in North Korea is looking to assert its power and to show that it obviously still exists on the world stage, and that this is not going to destabilize the country. So it might just be saber-rattling for the sake of saber-rattling at this point, but it is a quite a tense situation, and of course we see Asian currencies reacting with the weakening of Asian currencies across the board in the wake of this destabilization. So it's quite a tense situation, and one would imagine that the diplomats of every stripe from all the corners, especially the parties of the now-defunct six-party talks, would be interested in getting their fingers in this pie and trying to stabilize the relations now, especially because, of course, we know North Korea is a nuclear-armed country with international ballistic missiles.
And, of course, stability is the key word. It's what we're hearing from all corners. It's what people want on that Korean peninsula. Why do you think the North is seemingly wanting to isolate itself from the world at this critical point?
Well, I think the North has always been the sort of madwoman in the attic when it comes to East Asian politics, and it serves, I think, a useful function for a number of parties in the region, not only as a sort of proxy for China, which has been really propping up the regime internationally by giving it its support on the international stage, which can then use the menace of North Korea and be seen to be keeping North Korea in line, but it also serves a sort of strange function on the stage for example, the United States, which one would think would be interested in disarming North Korea. But in fact, in every single stage of North Korea's nuclear armament, the United States has been deeply involved with that. Not only the arming of the North Korean regime with two light water reactors back in the 1990s under Clinton, but the fact that deal was processed by a company called ABB, who just happened to have on its board at the time that deal went through none other than former U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. And then the other vector by which North Korea supposedly became a nuclear armed nation was through the AQCON network, which we now know through a series of whistleblowers and courtroom document revelations and leaked documents that AQCON network was infested from top to bottom with CIA and other assets of the American intelligence. So it's in a strange way, America has been deeply involved with the nuclear arming of North Korea, and it plays a very interesting counterpoint to the hysteria that we see going on over the possibility that Iran might one day develop a nuclear weapon. Well, here we have a nuclear-armed state that's been lobbing missiles over our head here in Japan for years now and threatening the entire region, and yet they've just walked away from those talks for the last 2 years. So it plays a very strange role in East Asian relations right now.
Well, just returning to immediately what's happened here, official reaction from Washington is that it is committed to stability on the Korean Peninsula and to the freedom and security of its allies, and it says that it's closely monitoring the situation on the peninsula. But it is tense there, as you were saying. South Korea is on high alert. Japan's warning of conflict, and China is sending its troops into the border with the North. Why do you think that these countries see danger in the power succession in North Korea at this point?
Well, it might be based on the false premise that Kim Jong-il really held any of the power in the day-to-day functioning of North Korea, which, of course, is just a military regime, and Kim Jong-il was really just window dressing for that regime. And in fact, as that report that we just listened to on RT mentioned, there are rumors that he's been dead for a number of years now. And, of course, we did have that strange succession ceremony last year where his son was officially appointed the successor back in September. And we had mainstream media, even the London Telegraph at the time, reporting that, in fact, Kim Jong-il was already dead. So, to a certain extent, I think that this change in leadership is really just a change in window dressing, but it could be used by a number of different parties, including the military dictatorship in power, to as a wild card to shake up relations. And of course, until we have some sort of normalization of the situation, it will remain a very, very tense situation here for the foreseeable future. So that's why I think there are so many very, very interested parties in this. at the moment trying to see if they're how things will play out. And of course, if these reports of missiles being launched are true, then obviously this could be a very, very, very potentially deadly and escalating situation. So we have to keep our eyes on it.
Indeed. Okay, James Corbett, editor of the Japan-based news website CorbettReport.com. Thank you.
Bringing out so many good points. And those aren't the things that you're going to hear your coworkers discussing at the water cooler about AQCon and the intelligence networks and Donald Rumsfeld and ABB and the military-industrial complex and the interlocking families. Something the previous clip mentioned that I also wanted to point out, they talked about the sky opened up and there was a double rainbow. I believe we tweeted out on our Media Monarchy feed, at Media Monarchy, that it happened again at the death of Kim Jong-il. Let's get our related geopolitics war horrors update. Syria death toll mounts despite peace moves. That's from the Financial Times. NATO blames bad maps for drone strike that killed 24 Pakistani troops. That is from InfoWars. And so is this. U.S. jets enter Iranian airspace. Oil depot bombed. Many other alternative media sites picked it up. I had it posted up as my geopolitical and war horror update list as well, until I was listening to last night's episode of Corbett Report Radio, Don't Trust the Media, where before I joined him for the second half to discuss Food World Order, he broke down that this story is actually from 2003, and if you click back all the way through to the source, it'll show 2003. So, just because we may think the mainstream media lies or lies by omission doesn't mean the alternative media always has it right, and I put myself right there as well. Continuing, Iran announces military exercise after Panetta. Remember, the switch. Panetta, now DOD, he was CIA, or wherever he was. But, of course, he refuses to rule out an attack.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Liam Panetta said Monday that Iran will have a nuclear weapon within 1 year, if not less. Panetta said Israel's concern for a nuclear Iran is a common concern of the U.S. and that Washington would not rule out a military attack.
Now, as we trumpeted last week, but here it is again, U.S. formally declares end of Iraq war. Meanwhile, Baghdad explosions kill 63. More on that from blacklistednews.com. Iraq's garbage holds reminders of a U.S. massacre. The colors have been cased. The command has been shut down. The war has been officially declared over. By December 31st, the final U.S. troops will come home, and Americans seem to have decided they're sick of hearing about Iraq. But Baghdad's trash heaps hold reminders of some of the war's lasting scars, in particular, the infamous 2005 massacre at Haditha. That's what Michael S. Schmidt discovered. Schmidt, a New York Times reporter, found hundreds of pages of interviews from the Marines' investigation into the massacre in, of all places, a junkyard near Baghdad. An attendant was burning them as fuel to cook a dinner of smoked carp, he writes, with a link to that piece from the New York Times. Eight soldiers charged in death of New York Private Danny Chin in Afghanistan. More on that from the New York Daily News. Owners launch lawsuit after bomb-sniffing dogs bound for Afghanistan are left to die at a U.S. airport. A military contractor has filed a lawsuit claiming negligence over 14 bomb-sniffing dogs found dead last year as they awaited shipment to assist U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Tiny, Rex, Rocky, Croc, Dork, Harry, Stress, Seago, Rex, Jaco, Kimbo, Kilo, Albert, and Back suffocated after being left in an unventilated truck. The suit filed in State District Court in Houston by the dog's owner, American Canine Detection Services of Lake County, Florida, seeks unspecified damages against Indian Creek Enterprises Incorporated and Live Animal Transportation Services. Closing out our geopolitics and war horrors updates, world leaders bid farewell to Vaclav Havel. World leaders pay respects to Czech playwright and former president. More on that from the BBC and the Chicago Tribune and on around the world. We look now to our econocrash news with a story from the New York Times where the headline just grabbed me and I've slightly adjusted it, but it is essentially the same. Signs point to economic rise at the end of 2011, but experts see a false dawn. As the fourth quarter draws to a close, a spate of unexpectedly good economic data suggests that it will have some of the fastest and strongest economic growth since the recovery started in 2009, causing a surge in the stock market and cheering economists, investors, and policymakers. In recent weeks, a broad range of data, like reports on new residential construction and small business confidence, have beaten analysts' expectations. Initial claims for jobless benefits, often an early indicator of where the labor market is headed, have dropped to their lowest level since May 2008. And prominent economics groups say the economy is growing 3 to 4 times as quickly as it was earlier in the year, at an annual pace of about 3.7%. But the good news also comes with a significant caveat. Many forecasters say the recent uptick probably does not represent the long-awaited start to a strong, sustainable recovery. Much of the current strength is caused by temporary factors, and economists expect growth to slow in the first half of 2012 to an annual pace of about 1.5 to 2%. Even that estimate could be optimistic if Washington lawmakers fail to extend aid for the long-term unemployed and a payroll tax cut for the United States' 160 million wage earners. At stake is about $150 billion, the bulk of which would go to middle-class families and the unemployed. If Congress does not pass the measures, economists say, it would significantly weaken growth from already damped levels anticipated early in the new year. And we can see, right now, all over the news, hurrah, hurrah, House Senate clear payroll tax accord. And Boehner made a statement late last night.
I don't think it's any time for celebration. Our economy is struggling. We've got a lot of work ahead of us in the coming year. But I want to wish the American people and all of my colleagues a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. You know, sometimes it's hard to do the right thing. And sometimes it's politically difficult to do the right thing. But, you know, when everybody called for a one-year extension of the payroll tax deduction, when everybody wanted a full year of extended unemployment benefits, we were here fighting for the right things. May not have been politically the smartest thing in the world, but let me tell you what. I think our members waged a good fight. We were able to come to an agreement. We were able to fix what came out of the Senate. You know, all year, you've heard me talk about short-term extensions, short-term gimmicks, and the consequences they have for our economy. And, you know, when you look at this, it's another short-term extension. This creates uncertainty for job creators. I used to run a small business. I know how this works. Kicking the can down the road for a couple of months does cause problems. And when you look at the reporting requirement that came out of this bill because it was hastily put together, it was a big burden for businesses, frankly, of all sizes.
Let's get our related EconoCrash updates. First, from the Economic Collapse blog, getting worse. 40 pieces of evidence that show America is in decline. And from the New York Times, economy contributes to slowest population growth since the 1940s. And our last EconoCrash update is a sob story. Automaker Saab files for bankruptcy in Sweden.
Well, it looks like the end of the road for the Swedish carmaker Saab. It's filed for bankruptcy after failing to secure fresh funds from potential Chinese investors. General Motors, a part owner of Saab, rejected the deal over concerns that China would have access to technology licenses. It's a big blow for fans of European vehicles like Clark Moore, the president of the Saab Car Club of Australia.
From April this year, things have been very interesting with Saab, with their finances. I did get a shock when I got a call at 10 o'clock last night to say that Saab had entered bankruptcy. I felt, this was something that was probably inevitable, but when it happened, I still got a sinking feeling.
Are you worried about being able to get parts and service in the future?
In these types of situations, the controls via the government put demands on the owners to produce parts for 7 years. I would expect that this will be the same for Saab. It's happened in the past with companies like MG and Rover, and parts are still available for those cars.
Clive Moore, what's so special about Saab?
Oh, Saabs have, I guess, a uniqueness about them. They're not common. Their technology is always up to date. And I think that people buy Saabs generally buy more than one. And I know in my club, we have more Saabs than members. I think it's 1.5 Saabs per member, and I think people regard them as a safe car and a great car to drive.
So in your opinion, is this really the end of the road for Saab?
Look, I have fingers crossed. I would like to think that Saab can survive. What happens in the next few weeks is really up to the Swedish government, who are managing the bankruptcy. I believe there are offers that are already coming through, and I hope that this will result in an outcome that's positive, and also for the 3,500 people plus more that live and work in Trollhättan for Saab.
Clive Moore in Melbourne, thanks for joining us.
Those are our EconoCrash updates, but as we try to point out in each and everything that we do, it is all connected. We move to our police state updates, contracts, stockpiles, and predictions, and we begin with one from our friends at theintelhub.com. Company that lobbied for the NDAA, that's the National Defense Authorization Act, gets a $23 million contract for equipment. According to reports from the Daily Kos and Russia Today, a company specializing in night raid equipment was awarded a $23 million contract from the Department of Defense and subsequently went on to lobby for the NDAA, which has given the government the power to indefinitely detain American citizens. Surefire LLC openly lobbied for the House version of the NDAA, a bill many have claimed has effectively ended the Bill of Rights, months after receiving the $23 million contract from the DOD. Why would this company be receiving a contract which could outfit at least 30,000 troops with new and updated night raid equipment when the U.S. is supposedly pulling troops out of Iraq and, to a smaller extent, Afghanistan? Why has this same company gone on to lobby for a bill that has turned the United States into a war zone? I think, unfortunately, you know the answer to those questions. Our related police state updates bear out what we've just told you. From AmericasWarWithin.org, North Dakota police stockpile high-tech combat-ready gear. If terrorists ever target Fargo, North Dakota, the local police will be ready. That piece from the Center for Investigative Reporting, written by Andrew Becker, again published on AmericasWarWithin.org. And we go back to the land of Katrina, where Louisiana state officials now call for National Guard troops on the streets.
A Louisiana state official says crime in New Orleans is out of control. So much so that he is now asking that the National Guard be brought in to patrol the city's streets. And this was all sparked by the recent death of a toddler. So here's the background. Just this past weekend, Kira Holmes was gunned down while playing outside of her home. And her family held a vigil with candles and birthday balloons in the same courtyard where she was killed. She was to be turning two right around Christmas. And emotions ran high as family members spoke of the little girl who never got to see her second birthday.
Grandbaby is gone. I will never see her first school. I will never see her go to church. Nothing. I have toys under my Christmas tree. I have stockings in my house. I didn't even want to have a Christmas this year because I felt like this. Now my baby gone. They have a conscience and do what they have to do and turn themselves, because that's my grandbaby. And I love her. They need to just turn themselves in. Do this for me. Do it for a grandmother. Have a conscience. Please have a heart and turn yourself in.
I want to bring in Louisiana State Representative Austin Badon. Joins me live from New Orleans. He is one of the officials who wants to bring the National Guard, just as they did after Hurricane Katrina. Mr. Badon, thank you for coming on. I've read that you said your city's at war. You need the National Guard. Why can't local police do the job?
Well, you know, we've done a lot after the storms of 2005, but this is it's just totally intolerable and it's unacceptable behavior in our city. The local police need help. We've been able to do a lot of different things that are building our city. We're rebuilding our infrastructure. We're building our schools back. We're building our economic base. But we have a select few people who are going out there and committing heinous crimes in broad daylight, killing people, killing babies. It's intolerable. We must do something about it. So what I have done is I have called called upon the governor to bring in the National Guard. After the storms of 2005, people were a lot more comfortable by seeing the National Guard on the streets of New Orleans, and it made the morale higher. We are doing a lot of good things. The people here in New Orleans are very resilient, and they're rebuilding, and they have a real great passion for our city. But we cannot allow certain individuals to carry guns and to go out and to shoot people on a daily basis in this city. So I've asked for the National Guard to come in and create order to assist the NOPD with support and also with patrols and help them to take this city back, because we are at war. When you're at war, you have to bring in soldiers.
Or like Immortal Technique said, martial law is coming soon to the hood to kill you. We close out our police state updates with Gerald Celente's dire predictions for 2012. They're posted on Blacklisted News, but it comes from trendsresearch.com, predicting nasty events before they happen, and he's been doing it very correctly for quite a while. Number one, economic martial law. Number two, Battlefield America. Number three, Invasion of the Octopi. Four, climax time, geopolitically and financially. The technocrat takeover, repatriate, repatriate. Secession obsession, safe havens, Big Brother Internet, direct versus faux democracy, alternative energy 2012, and going out in style. Affordable sophistication. In the bleak terrain of 2012 and beyond, affordable sophistication will direct and inspire products, fashion, music, the fine arts, and entertainment at all levels. U.S. businesses would be wise to wake up and tap into the dormant desire for old-time quality and the America that was. Gerald Celente knows what he's talking about. He's not someone that just exists on the fringes of the conspiracy world. He's paid, and he's well paid, by corporations to tell them what's going on. Because, again, most corporations, like hedge fund managers that don't care about record labels or food companies or any of those kind of things, they just need to diversify their portfolio. They need to go to other people to figure out what's going to be cool, whether that means cool hunters on the street taking pictures of who people that have cultivated their own original style and how that can be co-opted and sold back to the masses at Hot Topic and elsewhere. However, my friends, I digress. We've now reached the 1222 News Purge named for our opening track, Sometimes You Have to Work on Christmas. And we'll begin with our BioWars and EnviroHealth updates, and we take it from the top, from FukushimaUpdate.com, another one of the great outlets, from James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. Japan Prime Minister says Fukushima nuclear site finally stabilized. I suppose we can chalk that one up right again. The war is over, and it's morning in America, right? Let's listen to Arnie Gunderson on the statistically meaningful increase in West Coast cancer coming soon from Fukushima.
You'll never be able to prove that I got my cancer from smoking and you got yours from Fukushima. There's no way of detecting that. But we will see a statistically meaningful increase in cancers in Japan as a result of this.
Really? And these are small particulates that you're talking about. I think you used the term, were they gnats, radioactive gnats, I think you used once?
Fuel fleas.
Fuel fleas. So how? That's what people are taking a Geiger counter. They're putting on food and saying, okay, my food is safe, but they're not considering particulate matter. What is a particulate, nuclear particulate, and how devastating could a small particulate be to you?
That's the key to the whole discussion. The Japanese right now are measuring airborne dose. They're walking around with their dosimeter and saying it reads whatever. But that's an airborne dose from what's on the soil, what's been previously deposited on the soil. And it doesn't take into account any of these internal exposures from hot particles that either get in your GI tract or in your lungs. We've got pictures of kids' sneakers loaded with cesium. And you know if it's on the sneakers, it's in their hands are in their mouth. I'm certain that the body burden of cesium in kids in Fukushima Prefecture is quite high. The net effect of that, you can't measure that because your body self-shields. So if that's deep in your lung, there's, you know, there's mass between your lung and where the detector is, and you won't find it. That doesn't mean it's not there. We also saw on the first week of the accident, there's a couple other nasty gases that disappear very quickly, xenon and krypton. And the concentration in air was astronomical, and which means that the concentration in people's lungs were astronomical. The net effect of this is there's got to be, you know, significant increases in cancer in the Japanese population.
So you think a million people would be a reasonable estimate. So we have a 9/11, which is 3,000. We have Bhopal, which is 3,800 or so, and 200,000 injured. And then we have Fukushima, which is a potential impact of a million people. Is it limited to just Japan, or was it radiation particulate matter worldwide?
You know, we're at a point where you can't run, you can't hide. The after Japan, the next hottest area is the Cascades, the Pacific Cascades. A lot of that radiation came across the Pacific and hit the mountains, hit the Rockies, and deposited on the west side of the Rockies. We've seen readings in the Portland area of about 100 disintegrations per second in a square meter. So 3x3 has 100 disintegrations per second of cesium-134 and 137. Now, Japan has thousands, so it's much less than Japan. So the issue is, in Japan, it's a personal problem. You know, you can do things in your life to minimize the risk, and you can certainly get checked frequently so that if you get a cancer, it doesn't turn into a lethal cancer. In the U.S., it's different because the exposure is a lower level but spread out over millions of people up and down the West Coast. So I think we'll see over time a statistically meaningful increase in cancer on the West Coast, but I don't think we'll be able to compare by any means to what they got in Japan.
Right at my door. The rest of our BioWars EnviroHealth updates. Philippines sends coffins as flood toll death nears 1,000. President declares a state of national calamity. That phrase caught my eye. Meanwhile, river in China turns red. Illegal workshop dumps die into the pipe network. Drought has killed up to 10% of Texas woodland trees. Congress overturns incandescent light bulb ban. More on that story from the Washington Times. And as the climate control agenda pushes forward, we realize that, of course, we're broke. So even though they want to force these eugenical agendas, sometimes we just can't pay for it yet. Finally, unbelievably, our last BioWars updates. Louisiana warns after the second death of a brain-eating amoeba linked to tap water use in neti pots.
We now know more about the second death in Louisiana caused by a rare brain-eating amoeba. A 51-year-old woman from DeSoto Parish is the second person now to die since June. The parasite Nigleria grows in lukewarm water. The amoeba can only be contracted if infected water is snorted. It's commonly contracted by swimming or diving in warm freshwater lakes or rivers. Health officials say the infection typically starts with meningitis-like symptoms and is almost always fatal.
She presented, just like most of these cases do, with signs of meningitis. Had the fever and the headaches and muscle aches, not feeling good, throwing up.
Health officials say that you cannot contract the infection by bathing, and it's important to keep your water heaters turned up very high.
Little kids get in trouble for sticking things up their noses, but who knew doing so could be this dangerous, especially with a device that's supposed to keep you healthy. Doctors are now saying that improperly used neti pots have been linked to brain-eating amoeba infections, and those infections ended in death. WPVI has the story.
Officials have put out a warning about an increasingly popular health device known as a neti pot. The neti pot is commonly used to irrigate sinuses. A salt solution is often used in the pot. But officials say many people make the mistake of dissolving the salt with tap water. Officials say tap water is not safe to use in neti pots because it's not sterile.
And KVUE spoke with a doctor.
You use it, you put it up, it's wet and moist, and what things grow in there is incredible.
The dangerous neti pot news broke after two people died in Louisiana. KTVX explains.
According to Louisiana health regulators, two people there died after using tap water that was infected with the amoeba Nagliera fowleri. The parasite penetrates the thin bone that's between your sinuses and your brain, causing an infection.
And then you get meningitis and meningoencephalitis and basically a brain infection that is lethal.
lethal in almost all cases. Time explains exactly how the scary infection works, but notes that though it's lethal, it's also unlikely. Typically, Naegleria fowleri infection occurs when people go swimming or diving in warm freshwater lakes and rivers, particularly in summer in the southern U.S. Last summer, at least three other people died from Naegleria fowleri infection in Florida, Virginia, and Kansas. The amoeba enters through the nose, travels to the brain, and starts eating neurons. It's also exceedingly rare. In the 10 years from 2001 to 2010, only 32 infections were reported in the U.S. Rare or not, a sinus infection is better than a brain infection any day.
The Louisiana Department of Health and Hospitals says there's a dangerous amoeba lurking in tap water and it can eat your brain. They issued a warning after two people in the state died. But the organism won't kill you if you simply drink the water, but it is lethal if it goes up your nose somehow and gets lodged in your sinuses. And that's where the neti pot comes in. People use neti pots to clean out their nasal passages and supposedly this helps with sinus problems. But when the Naegleria fowleri parasite enters your nose because it was in the water you put in the pot, it can travel to your brain, cause drowsiness, vomiting, sometimes even hallucinations and eventually death. But don't panic, you can still use your neti pot. Just sterilize the water or simply boil it.
Now, I find it interesting that all three of those clips are read by women and they're all done in a sort of, oh gosh, isn't this funny? But it seems as though within every episode of Media Monarchy, there's a story that is easily a horror movie script waiting to happen. And what they don't mention in this is what is in our water. And yes, they say some of it is naturally occurring, and they mention some other states. But we've discussed so many times on Food World Order and other sites about the chemicals, the pharmaceuticals, the toxins within the water. That is, I believe, another example of how a story breaks large in the news, and it's kind of a odd, you know, news of the weird human interest story, but the subtext is not presented. Let's move to our drug war updates. Drug war's focus turns to pharmaceuticals. This piece is quite interesting, and it discusses pill mills concentrating on what's coming from doctors' offices and pharmacies. Meanwhile, FDA approves trials of anti-AIDS vaccine, and our last drug war note again brings up, as we seem to have to do lately, the crumbling Draco-Rama world of sports. Chicago Bear Sam Hurd busted in a drug distribution ring.
News just into us here at CNN. The Chicago Bears wide receiver arrested in a massive drug bust has now been cut from the team. I'm talking about Sam Hurd. He was busted by federal agents just 2 days ago for allegedly trying to set up a massive ongoing drug deal. According to federal charges, the scope was mind-boggling. Chicago Sun-Times columnist Sean Jensen has known Hurd since he arrived from the Dallas Cowboys just this past July. Joins me by phone. Sean, I know you were in that newser. You're at Chicago Bears headquarters right now. Who spoke and what did they say?
It was Bears general manager Jerry Angelo. He addressed reporters. He typically doesn't do that during the football season, but obviously given the extenuating circumstances, he wanted to provide clarity on the team's position with Sam Hurd. His points were that the Bears had no idea of any of this. There weren't any facts. There weren't any red flags about Sam Hurd, who didn't have a criminal background or anything. And he made clear that the Bears will release him later this afternoon via the NFL's official process. And so Sam Hurd, by the end of the day, will not be a Chicago Bear any longer.
So presumably Jerry Angelo shocked by this and the
absolutely.
Rest of the team.
Absolutely. Everybody throughout this building is shocked by this revelation the other day. I mean, the team didn't know anything of it until Thursday morning when Sam Hurd wasn't in the usual receiver meeting. That's when they started, you know, asking around and figuring out what happened. And so this is a shock. I mean, if you would have asked me to, if you would have said there's going to be a Bears player who's going to have federal drug charges levied against them and gave me 30 guesses, Sam Hurd would not have been one of those guys. He appeared to be a Christian. He would hum and sing, you know, gospel songs walking around the building. He was one of the most cordial, friendly, and accountable players on this team. And his teammates, you know, they really liked and respected him. So this is a shock.
Okay, Sean Jensen, let's back up because here's this guy's wide receiver, Chicago Bears, $5.1 million, three-year contract, just came from the Cowboys, came on to Chicago in July. But let's get into the numbers, because the numbers here tell the story, at least allegedly, as to what he's potentially involved in. I mean, let's go back to Wednesday night and the steak dinner. Who was there? What was he involved with?
Well, I don't know exactly who was there, but, you know, we reported that he was at Morton Steakhouse in Rosemont, which is just a suburb right near the airport between the city and O'Hare International. And what we do know for sure is that it was Sam Hurd was there, and that an undercover agent that Sam Hurd believed was a supplier was at the dinner. And Hurd told this, you know, this undercover agent that he was already moving 4 kilograms of cocaine a week, and that he needed 5 to 10 more, and that his current supplier couldn't do it. And so he said that, you know, allegedly, according to the Homeland Security report. And then he accepted a kilo of cocaine, walked out of the restaurant, and then he was arrested in the parking lot. So that's what we know. Again, Baird's officials didn't know anything of it until Thursday morning. And as details come out, I mean, it's just, you know, people here are shocked. I mean, they're trying their best, because on the football field, this team has to win. You know, they're looking on the they're in the outside looking in for a playoff spot, and they're in a must-win situation on Sunday. But there's no question that this is a big distraction for this football team right now.
Sean, let me also ask you about this, because I know there's a radio station in Chicago that is reporting there was a list that exists that details fellow players who Sam Hurd was allegedly selling to. Can you confirm that?
Right,
CNN actually has not been able to.
Exactly. The Sun-Times has not been able to confirm that report, and I just got off the phone with Sam Hurd's attorney, David Kenner, who's based in L.A. He told me that from all the information that they've gotten, that there is no indication that this is true. They simply don't believe that this is an accurate report. And, you know, they're not buying into this at this point. And so that obviously would be huge if that were the case. But again, we have not been able to confirm that. And the attorney is refusing to accept that and saying that that is not the case.
Jocko Ramos, save our souls. We are blasting through the 1222 News Purge. Sometimes you have to work on Christmas, and we reach our media, memes, updates. And the first three we're going to grab from the always fascinating VigilantCitizen.com. From mind control to superstardom, the meaning of Lady Gaga's latest video, Marry the Night. And as long as we're talking about showy pop models, the esoteric meaning of Florence and the Machine's two newest videos, Shake It Out and No Light. And lastly, from VigilantCitizen.com, one of Britney Spears' ex-husbands, and I believe they were only married for a couple of days, says of her newest and latest engagement, quote, "It's fake. She marries her handler. She always has someone controlling her," end quote. And the specter of the star whackers that floated over this past year is never far away from these media memes. Meanwhile, Netflix CEO Reed Hastings' yearly stock option allowance cut by half for 2012. We mentioned that in the breaking news at the top of the show. And our last media meme update, one obituary note. Ralph McDonald, Grammy Award-winning songwriter, wrote Just the Two of Us, which was made a hit by Grover Washington Jr., and the born in West Virginia Bill Withers, who you know from Lean On Me. So Ralph McDonald, the writer of Just the Two of Us and many other songs, dies at the age of 67. And we move to our murder and mayhem updates from the New York Times, from the New Jersey Ledger, and from Bloomberg. Five dead as plane crashes on Jersey Interstate. New details emerge in doomed flight that killed five in Morris County, New Jersey. And the last note from Bloomberg, debris recovery resumes in crash that killed Green Hill managers. Investigators resumed recovering debris from the plane crash that killed all five people aboard, including two managing directors of Green Hill and Company. Anytime we see things happening with the banksters and the elites, we don't call conspiracy on everything, but anytime there are crashes involving people involved in things that involve the destruction of everything we see, you gotta wonder if people get taken out. Just speculation. Closing out on the mayhem side, and I perhaps could have put this elsewhere in the kingdom, but we just grab it from the, in this case, appropriately named Sideshow blog on Yahoo, Healthy Two-Headed Baby Born in Brazil. And we shift gears and get our Obamasiah updates, both of which have to do with the Honorable Dr. Ron Paul. With a piece from the Washington Post, Ron Paul could win in Iowa, chances of GOP nomination still slim. They point out, of course, he has become a major contender. And they link to a different recent piece from the Washington Post, basically laying all that out. So as the stakes rise in this emotional con game, it rises again, and Ron Paul battles the media over the racist newsletters.
The words themselves are shocking, but who wrote them? Iowa frontrunner Ron Paul is fending off questions about writings that appeared in a newsletter bearing his name and circulated in the late 80s and early 90s. Here's KTDC with more.
Here's one snippet that went out in a letter after the Los Angeles riots. It said, quote, "Order was only restored in L.A. when it came time for the blacks to pick up their welfare checks," unquote. Another poked fun at the justice system in Washington, D.C., saying, quote, "I think we can safely assume that 95% of the black males in that city are semi-criminal or entirely criminal."
The contents are not new. In fact, they were hashed out pretty extensively during the last presidential election cycle. But when CNN's Gloria Borger brought them back up Wednesday, the congressman cut the interview short.
I mean, is it a legitimate question to ask that something
yeah,
went out
and when you get
your
the
name?
And when you get the answer, it's legitimate that you sort of take the answers I get. You know what? The answer is I didn't write them. I didn't read them at the time, and I disavow them. That is the answer.
Well, it's just a question. I mean, it's legitimate. It's legitimate. These things are pretty incendiary.
Goodbye.
All right. Thank you, Congressman.
The newsletter bore titles like The Ron Paul Political Report and Ron Paul's Freedom Project, and it appears Paul's been fielding questions about their content for more than a decade. In 1996, the Dallas Morning News reported the congressman had written the letters and asked him about them, specifically one that called black teenagers, quote, "unbelievably fleet of foot." Dr. Paul said he was not evoking stereotypes when he wrote the columns. He said they should be read and quoted in their entirety to avoid misrepresentation. In the interview, he did not deny he made the statement about the swiftness of black men. If you try to catch someone that has stolen a purse from you, there is no chance to catch them. Yet, at least since 2008, Paul's staffers and the candidate himself have been saying he didn't write the newsletters. But to the Washington Post's Jonathan Capehart, it doesn't matter who put pen to paper. Paul literally attached his name to newsletters that published vile, racist statements about African Americans. The Republican Party has a serious problem. Previous flavors of the month, Newt Gingrich, Rick Perry, and Herman Cain, had no business running for president, given their disqualifying baggage. Now, we can add Paul to the list. But The Atlantic's Michael Daugherty is willing to cut Paul some slack. Just a little. The newsletters don't sound like Ron Paul. He doesn't do wordplay or use prefixes. Further, most newsletter and direct mail operations in politics employ ghostwriters. But the questions remain. If Ron Paul is so libertarian that he won't even police people who use his name, if his movement is filled with incompetence and opportunists, then what kind of president would he make?
We're doing the 12/22 news purge. Sometimes you have to work on Christmas, and we can glance at updates and see tight race in Iowa, Ron Paul essentially in the lead. As the Iowa caucuses come up, I believe, very early in January. There's also articles, Ron Paul brings out older voters in Iowa, and I would say that's a way to win. But our Oregon oddities are this, from our own Willamette Week, WWeek.com, Nike leaks, how Oregon's top company fights corruption, counterfeiting, and Croatian smugglers. Thanks to Julian Assange, we now know how Oregon's top company fights corruption, counterfeiting, and Croatian smugglers. A massive article and a link to, again, from WWeek.com. You can browse all 184-ounce secret State Department documents, the Nike leaks cables. And we close out the 12/22 news purge with West Virginia worry, with a little bit of Mothman and the 44th anniversary of the Silver Bridge collapse. We discussed this story in detail back on the anniversary in 2007 on this site and on this show on MediaMonarchy.com. But we'll grab a quick update from MyDailySentinel.com. Dateline, Point Pleasant. I couldn't understand why I made it. These were the words plastered across the December 16th, 1967 edition of the Point Pleasant Register, and a sentiment echoed by many in the Tri-County area after the collapse of the Silver Bridge on December 15th, 1967. And I provide the link to copycateffect.com for the sinister forces and the interesting connections concerning the sightings of this alleged Mothman, and that's what the Richard Gere film Mothman Prophecies is about, as a harbinger of the collapse of the Silver Bridge, which would happen right before Christmas in, again, my home state of West Virginia. I believe we speculated last week or the week before, again, of the Garuda, the Virginia Tech mascot, bringing so much destruction there in Blacksburg. But we close out that 1222 news purge. Sometimes you have to work on Christmas, and we have all the other alternative media from the Media Monarchy Kingdom, from Food World Order, Cyberspace War, and we'll begin with Holy Hexes right after this.
Sing me. In the hot sun of a Christmas day, but they won't find me. In the hot sun of a Christmas day, I walk the streets in the hot sun of a Christmas day. Everybody's blind, in the hot sun of a Christmas day. I need my girl in the hot sun of a Christmas day. She seems to love me less in the hot sun of a Christmas day. Machine gun in the hot sun of a Christmas day. They killed someone else in the hot sun of a Christmas day.
From the Prefuse 73 mixtape called T5 Soul Sessions. I don't know the artist, I don't know the name. Scott Heron, a.k.a. Prefuse 73, when he released that Soul Sessions mixtape, he intentionally didn't tell anybody what's on it. And maybe with a little more searching, I can perhaps find that out. But we're well into hour number two, my friends, of episode 244 of MediaMonarchy.com. It's Christmas Eve, December 23rd, 2011, and my name is James Evan Pilato, your host and webmaster of the site and show MediaMonarchy.com, which has so much to cover as we now move to the other sister sites in the kingdom. And we begin with HolyHexes.com. Scientists conclude no scientific explanation for the Shroud of Turin. From WHTC.com, Italian researchers concluded Wednesday that there's no scientific explanation for the image that appears on the Shroud of Turin. For believers, the shroud is thought to have on it a chemical copy of the face of Jesus Christ. In 2006, the National Agency for New Technologies, Energy, and Sustainable Economic Development had believed the imprint on the cloth had been created by an ultraviolet flash of light. Further research by the agency was necessary to investigate the fact that ultraviolet technology was not available during that time period. As a result, after 5 years of research and experiments, the agency has concluded that the image is not the result of any process known to the modern world. Additionally, the study showed that imprint left on the shroud may have been created by an intense light source, but no man-made source could have produced the strength required to leave the image. The new information doesn't prove, however, that the Shroud of Turin is an imprint by Jesus, but supporters are likely to take the research as proof of divine power. Or, as we would say, sinister forces. Or holy hexes. From MSNBC, Vatican goes high-tech to preserve fragile ancient tomes. One of the world's oldest libraries in Rome faces a huge problem. How to preserve 1,800-year-old manuscripts in a digital format that's readable for next-generation computers. A format designed to store images taken by satellites and orbital telescopes such as Hubble could offer a solution to the Holy See's Vatican Library. Archivists have already begun scanning the fragile ancient tomes in the Vatican's collections with software that can transform old pages pressed against glass into an accurate flat digital image. Such images saved in the Flexible Image Transport System, FITS, format, designed by NASA and European space scientists in the 1970s, will allow computers built even 100 years from now to decode whatever information is stored. And for the hat trick of European Christianity news, Pope Benedict peace message calls for wealth redistribution. From the religious news service press release by way of the Huffington Post, noting a rising sense of frustration at the world economic recession, Pope Benedict Joey Ratz says that a more just and peaceful world requires adequate mechanisms for the redistribution of wealth. The Pope's words appeared in his message for the World Day of Peace 2012, released on Friday, last Friday, December 16th, at the Vatican. The message laments that, quote, some currents of modern culture, built upon rationalist and individualist economic principles, have cut off the concept of justice from its transcendent roots, detaching it from charity and solidarity, end quote. This seems to be just a furthering of something we covered recently, and that, again, was the Pope essentially echoing the Occupy movements, essentially echoing the elites movements, and that is a one-world system. Money, God, military. London, Vatican City, District of Criminals. Institutional Dutch Catholic abuse affected thousands. From the BBC, tens of thousands of children have suffered sexual abuse in Dutch Catholic institutions since 1945, a report says. The report, with the link for you to the actual PDF, it was by an independent commission, said Catholic officials had failed to tackle the widespread abuse at schools, seminaries, and orphanages. But the report also found that one in five children who attended an institution suffered abuse regardless of whether it was Catholic. This episode fills us with shame and sorrow, said a bishop's statement. The report estimates that between 10 and 20,000 minors were abused in the care of Catholic institutions between 1945 and 1981, when the number of church-run homes dropped. In the years between 1981 and 2011, several more thousands suffered at the hands of priests and others working for the church.
Tens of thousands of children have suffered sexual abuse in Dutch Catholic institutions, according to a report by an independent commission. It says that church officials apparently failed to adequately deal with the abuse or to help the victims. The commission added that it received more than 1,000 actual reports of abuse at Catholic schools, seminaries and orphanages. Well, on the line from The Hague is the BBC's Anna Holligan. Anna, a report that takes us right back to the end of the Second World War. Pretty shocking reading.
Exactly. It goes right back to 1945, this Wim Dietman report carried out independently. It estimated that 20% of children who spent some of their life in a Catholic institution suffered from some form of abuse. And they looked at almost 2,000 reports, 1,800 reports of abuse happening at Catholic schools and seminaries. And this investigation, it was carried out to try and discover what exactly went on in those institutions, how it could have happened, and what kind of justice should be offered to the victim.
Right. At this stage, Anna, how much recognition has been made by the Catholic Church of these sorts of abuses?
Well, they agreed to this investigation. They agreed that it was necessary to try and, they say, clean the slate. And they also last month set up a compensation system which had a kind of a scale depending on how serious the abuse was. So starting from compensation of around $6,500 and rising to a maximum of $130,000 depending on the nature of the abuse. And it's a really significant thing here because around 29% of the Dutch population have been identified as being Catholic. So it's getting a lot of attention here in the Netherlands.
Okay, Anna for now. Thanks very much. Anna Holligan at The Hague.
From abuse in our churches to abuse in our schools and sports institutions. Quickly, a brief mention of all the Penn State scandal updates. And again, last week, two winners. We've sent out two copies of The Franklin Scandal by Nick Bryant, published by Oregon's own Trine Day Books. Because again, as we've been saying from the very beginning, stop being surprised about the Penn State scandal and learn about the Franklin scandal and how all of these connect to inbred, multi-generational serial killers, child kidnapping, child trafficking, and worse and more. Mike McQuarrie, whistleblower and whipping boy in the Penn State scandal. Bob Braun reveals in an article on NJ.com, it's a choice between livelihood or moral. Jerry Sandusky's wife says, oh, he didn't harm kids. And as we were on the air last week, we gave you some of the updates on what McQuarrie and others said at last Friday's hearing. That post is up for you with links, of course, to ESPN. But the Associated Press says that Penn State Jerry Sandusky scandal is 2011's number one sports story. The Associated Press voted Jerry Sandusky scandal the number one sports story for 2011, according to NBC Sports, with a link for you there. I believe The Onion tweeted out something about some, you know, coach or someone given an award for not being involved in many sex scandals in the past year, something like that. But it's not just Penn State, as we said. It's also Syracuse as well. Bernie Fine scandal update. A third accuser pleads guilty to child sex abuse. Bernie Fine Syracuse sex scandal update. Is the cover-up already at work? More from CNN and flashbacks to our own bits over the past months on HolyHexes.com. And the last couple posts on Holy Hexes will shift gears out of the disgusting child kidnapping rings that, again, like the Washington Times said in 1989, homosexual prostitution inquiry snares VPs within Reagan-Bush White House. Callboys took late-night tour of White House. And they are all connected, and they're connected even back to this. The Wulzburg, Grail Castle of the Nazi regime. Heinrich Himmler envisioned Wulzburg Castle as an SS occult center when he leased it in 1934 as a place for marriage rites, celebrations, and research. Writer-researcher Philip Coppens, in his article, The Wulzburg, the Nazi Grail Castle, provides a survey of the present castle, constructed in 1603. And Coppins writes, quote, "The Wolfsburg was going to be the grail castle of the Nazi regime once it had established itself as rulers of the world." Philip Coppins, you may hear frequently on RedIceCreations.com. But back here in the North American Union, in the puritanical state, menorahs lighted in New York and the District of Criminals from CNN, from the big balloons at the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade to a big Christmas tree at Manhattan's Rockefeller Center. The Big Apple is known for going big around the holidays, and this past Tuesday, the first night of the Jewish holiday of Hanukkah, New Yorkers went big again, lighting a massive menorah outside the south side of Central Park. The nine-branched candelabra, 32 feet tall, 28 feet wide, weighs 4,000 pounds, and is considered the world's biggest, according to the Guinness Book of World Records. In the nation's capital, a special lighting ceremony near the White House also marked the start of the holiday. So said Obamasiah, quote, "Tonight, as families and friends come together to light the menorah, it is a story that reminds us to count our blessings, to honor the sacrifices of our ancestors, to believe that through faith and determination, we can work together to build a brighter, better world for generations to come."
Rabbi Yossi Shem Tov, and he is with the Chabad House, the director, in fact, and it is located in Sylvania Township, and we're getting ready for Hanukkah here.
Very exciting. Hanukkah has a double message. One is a very American message of religious freedom. The Greek-Syrian armies, 2,000 years ago, fought to disallow the Jewish people from keeping their traditions. The minority, the Maccabees, said no. And God performed a miracle. And not only were they victorious, but when they went into the temple and they found that all the oil was destroyed and contaminated, they found one jug of oil that was pure with a seal of the high priest that kindled the candelabra in the temple, and it was should have lasted only for one night. It lasted for 8 days. To commemorate that victory, every night we light the menorah. The message that even if you're a minority, and thank God in our great country, if you have traditions from your family, go for it. This is the second message.
Okay.
Share it. If you have joy in your house, if you have inspiration in your house, the mitzvah of the Hanukkah menorah is that we light the one candle, but not on our table in our kitchen. We move the curtains away, we place the table near the window, and only when it's dark outside, when people are outside in the dark, and you have joy, and you have a candelabra, brighten up the world outside for everyone else also. In America, nice. We could do it.
That's wonderful.
One more message.
Okay.
And that is, the first night, if you kindled one candle and you brightened up the world outside, that's great. The second night, that's not good enough. You have to have two candles. And the third night, three. And the same thing in our lives. Every day, we have to do more and more, not only for ourselves, but for the community.
Thank you for the explanation of Hanukkah and the menorah.
Isn't it interesting how all our high, holy, quasi-religious events all seem to happen around astro-theological, astronomical events? As above, so below. Winter Solstice 2011, pagan celebrations mark the shortest day of the year. We've got a piece from the National Post getting into wherever you were in the world, December 21st or the 22nd, marking the winter solstice. Solstice meaning Latin for sun, stand still. And the headline was enough from the LA Times. Solstice means illumination at California Mission. And it's an easy transition from Holy Hexes to cyberspacewar.com as we welcome the winter solstice and turn towards the light. And the Christian Science Monitor had a funny post. Earth's northern half plunged into darkness by axial tilt. Will the sunlight ever return? Echoing something probably written by The Onion. But our 1222 DEFCON planets, tweets, and patents, two Earth-sized planets discovered orbiting a star. More from the San Francisco Guardian. Another week, another mention of new discoveries of new planets as some type of disclosure is happening before our very eyes. DARPA's new spy satellite could provide real-time video from anywhere on Earth. That's from StratRisks.com. And the Taliban and the U.S. military are waging a war via Twitter. Meanwhile, Twitter use by Shabab in Somalia incites the U.S. Those coming from the New York Times and the New York Daily News, respectively, And our last note on that brief 1222 DEFCON planets, tweets, and patents from the New York Times again. Apple wins partial victory on patent claim over Android. In other news, Peter robs Paul. GPS spoofing secret to capture of CIA Sentinel drone. Iran engineer claims GPS spoofing technique was the secret to the capture of that recent CIA drone, according to a Mail Online article at the Daily Mail. Iran has taken it on the chin for nearly 3 years with assassinated nuclear scientists, an explosion at a missile site, and nuclear facilities sabotaged by the computer virus Stuxnet created by USREAL. Have the Iranians now found a way to fight back? Will we hear more about GPS spoofing vulnerability? One anonymous comment gives a link to cryptome.org getting into the Iran RSA cipher. Connecting right to that, flashing back to episode 22 of Corbett Report Radio on the false flag scenario of a drone attack on U.S. soil, and you've heard us both discuss that in recent weeks. Webster Tarpon called it virtual flag terrorism. But remember, last year, U.S. Navy drone, a fire scout, wandered over the D.C. airspace. And now we have the recent report of software at Creech Air Force Base in Nevada running drones hit with virus infection. Iran also reported that CIA drone within its borders. And finally, the precedent-setting arrest of U.S. citizens in North Dakota this summer after a drone assisted in intelligence gathering. The rest in cyberspace war, TGFS, terrestrial gamma ray flashes and antimatter from dailygalaxy.com. UFO Encounters Live, hosted by Ronnie McMullen. More at ufoencounterslive.podomatic.com. And we also have Weekend Retrovision for last week. Cosmos with Carl Sagan. All 13 episodes are available on Hulu, but they are also available, and you'd know about it, if you follow at Navigate Netflix, the Twitter feed for Navigating Netflix, the community within TragedyAndHope.com, designed to prioritize your time for movies that feed your mind. From 1980, Carl Sagan, Cosmos, A Personal Voyage. I'd never watched it before. I'm watching a little bit of it now. It is quite interesting, and I was going to include something someone told me about, Symphony of Science, where people have taken Carl Sagan and other scientists, and of course, auto-tuned them, making a Symphony of Science, but I couldn't find any that was just Carl Sagan. There were Stephen Hawking and all kinds of other guys, again, that you'd see on History Channel, ancient alien shows, or again, Coast to Coast or Red Ice Radio. But this closes out cyberspacewar.com, and this was our second story on the most recent episode of NewWorldNextWeek.com on the Bradley Manning case. Investigators show evidence of WikiLeaks link. And we have other links for you from the Washington Post to Twitter to France 24. Again, from the Washington Post, and also from YouTube, and the picture that I post along with this is a current picture, and it is of Bradley Manning being moved either to or from his military tribunal. But if I implore you to go look at this photo, and if he does not resemble and is not the spitting image of Lee Harvey Oswald, then I don't know who is. Investigators claim link of Manning and Assange.
On Friday, the Article 32 pretrial hearing for Bradley Manning began at Fort Meade, and it still goes on. Today is, in fact, day four of this hearing. As we mentioned to you before, media access has been limited and strictly monitored, and today some of it was blacked out as discussion over the materials in the leaks went forward. Material that the government continues to label as classified, despite it being out in the open, on the internet, written about by most media outlets for all to see. Now, here are a few tidbits from the last few days. So far, two witnesses have invoked their rights not to testify in court and incriminate themselves. Special agent within the military's criminal investigation division testified that Manning was arrested based on unconfirmed chat logs. And those chat logs between Manning and Adrian Lameau have been found on Manning's computers, as well as 10,000 cables. But the real kicker from today was that a government digital forensic examiner said that he retrieved communications between Bradley Manning and an online chat user named Julian Assange. So let's get more of those details. Here to discuss this with me is Daniel Ellsberg, former U.S. military analyst who famously leaked the Pentagon Papers in 1971, and Kevin Gostolis, civil liberties blogger for Fire Dog Lake. Gentlemen, I want to thank you both for joining us tonight. And Kevin, I want to start with you because I know that you've been covering this pretrial hearing from the moment that it began, and specifically about this news today that they think that they found a chat between Manning and another user named Julian Assange. Can you give some more details?
Right. I would say this is the closest that we have gotten to seeing the prosecution actually prove there is some sort of link between Julian Assange and Bradley Manning. And I would say that it is very evident now that Manning was actively seeking out information about WikiLeaks, and the prosecution has raised numerous times that he was interested in Iceland, which was a base of operations.
So in that sense, can we say that this is kind of damning news for Bradley Manning, or perhaps even for Julian Assange, who has always claimed that he didn't know or he does not know who his sources are? What do you think, Daniel?
I would hardly call it damning. I like to think of President Obama as giving credit to Bradley Manning by accusing him of putting out this information. Certainly it's made him my hero and that of a lot of other people. So I wouldn't call it damning.
What do you think in terms of the case that they're trying to build, the grand jury that's going on in Virginia being built against WikiLeaks, and what Bradley Manning's own fate might be?
So the fear here is that because Paul Almanza, who is the investigative officer presiding, because he has a backstory with the Department of Justice, the fear that the defense has is that they're going to try to flip Bradley Manning and use him to go after Julian Assange, to go get the rest of these characters that we mostly do not know who have affiliations with WikiLeaks. And I guess the more that they back the defense into the corner, the more I would guess a plea bargain deal or some kind during a court-martial hearing would seem to be would be appealing.
That's everything from Innerspace and Outer Space on cyberspacewar.com. And we move for the remainder of our show to foodworldorder.com and begin with a story that we discussed last night on Corbett Report Radio. And again, Thursday nights now, 9:30 Pacific time. We are joining James Corbett live on the Republic Broadcasting Network to discuss the world of food, health, and the environment. And the story we began with last night, U.S. food aid for North Korea would bring nuclear talks a step closer. And we will see very much more about this in the coming days, weeks, and months. But all the rest. In Georgia, pecan thieves find a windfall at $1.50 a pound. To an enterprising thief or even a casual dabbler in crime, the fallen pecans that cover thousands of acres of unpatrolled Georgia nut orchards might as well be a carpet of nickels. Scoop up a pound, 30 nuts or so, and it can be cashed in for as much as $1.50 at the local buying station. A more organized criminal might cut a hole in a fence at a nut cleaning plant and drive away with a couple $1,000s worth of top quality pecans. Nut theft has long been a reality here in the nation's pecan belt. It has become such a way of life that a South Georgia rapper, Hawk Dog, even has a song about it. Crank that pecan.
Ain't no real pecan picker, you can listen to my shit. Turn my vocals up, turn my vocals up, nigga. First you gotta plug it, plug it, then you grab it, bang, bang. Then you gotta kick it, crank that pecan on his ass. Crank that pecan on his ass. Crank that pecan on his ass. First you gotta plug it, plug it, then you grab it, bang, bang. Then you gotta kick it, crank that pecan on his ass. Like I crank my motorbike. Fuck a Walmart bag, I need a Kroger site. Pecan season is kinda like trap season. If your money ain't by pecans, then I don't need it. Okay, I'm on the move from tree to tree. Don't be surprised if you catch me on your grandma's tree. Started pick when I was 5 years old. In the cold, snotty nose with a big bang roll. First you grab a stick, stick, then you knock me down. If you jelly, pick them up off the grind. Just crack that pecan dance, it ain't a hard dance. If a nigga hatin' and I approach you like a kickstand.
What's up, man?
Pecan, man.
Yeah, I'm a pecan, man.
Pecan,
I got the old lady.
Hell, it probably be your grandma, too. Man, now I gotta go, though. I'll let y'all tomorrow.
First, you gotta plug it, plug it, then you gotta bang, bang. Then you gotta stick it, crack that pecan on his own. Crack that pecan on his own. Crack that pecan on his own. First, you gotta plug it, plug it, then you gotta bang, bang. Then you gotta stick it, crack that pecan on his own. Crack that pecan on his own. Crack that pecan on his own. B-E-C-A-N, that's the season. I pick them when I go broke, yeah, that's the reason. I'm winding my little Pinto around town. My rim sitting 32 inches off the ground. Pecan coated with wood grain interior. Haters, my roots is up, so now I ain't hearing ya. Drive by so I can pick up my brother Rick. So I can ask
him, hey, man, who got another pecan
stick? All coat aside, he be like, yeah, I might. Just look in my room, in the closet to the right. I'm feeling happy now, I got 100 pounds. Don't ask me where I get them, duh, on the ground. First you gotta plug it, plug it, then you gotta bang, bang. Then you gotta stick it, plug that pecan on his own. Plug that pecan on his own. Plug that pecan on his own. First you gotta plug it, plug it, then you gotta bang, bang.
Shit, hard day at work. Yeah, I got 200 pounds, about $200.
Oh, that girl hop again, the pecan man. Nigga, you ain't nothing. Come on to the car, pick pecan with you, fool.
I ain't gonna do nothing to play. I don't wanna play about my money.
Nigga.
Damn. Hello, who this here?
Is anybody home?
Yeah, who this here?
It's Miss Jenkins.
Oh, shit.
You was picking on my pecan tree today.
Pick on your pecan tree.
Boy, I'ma get you.
Get off my damn porch, Miss Jenkins.
I don't care if they call you pecan man or what, but I'ma rip you off.
That ain't your property. Hey. Let me get a shout out to the whole squad. Dino, Spud, my brother Young Cad, Javon, Red Car, whole CCHS, you know what I'm saying? Who wanna crack that pecan, nigga? And for them haters, man, y'all know I can't forget my nigga Wody.
Crank that pecan, Hawk. Dog. Continuing on foodworldorder.com, fast food outlet stirs concerns in a mecca of healthy living in the small city of Loma Linda, California, home to a large Seventh-day Adventist community. The average lifespan goes well past 80, and it has one of the highest rates of longevity in the world, according to some estimates. So last week, when the city council approved Loma Linda's first McDonald's restaurant, many residents bemoaned the decision, worrying that the officials were jeopardizing the city's reputation as a paragon of healthy lifestyles. Continuing from the Los Angeles Times, giving salty food to babies may create a lifelong preference. Feeding young babies solid foods such as crackers, cereals, and bread, which tend to be high in salt, may set them up for a lifelong preference for salt, researchers reported Tuesday. The study, published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, which they are not giving up in full. You can read the abstract, however, with a link to AJCN.org, suggests that efforts to reduce salt intake among Americans should begin early in life. It's even possible, the author said, that infancy contains a sensitivity window. A 2010 report from the Institute of Medicine concluded that the average intake of 3,436 milligrams a day for Americans over age 2 is more than doubles what was recommended. And what is it about America's fondness for salt? But the 1222 binge and purge, balls, falls, crackdowns in food carts, 2011 in food, less gluten, more kale, and sweaty balls. If you don't know what any of those are, some we've discussed, some we have not. More on that from the Associated Press. And something we mentioned last night on Corbett Report Radio from grist.org, the good food news of 2011. but it doesn't include the rest of these. Food inflation falls to four-year low in India. Meanwhile, a cardamom auction will resume in India on December 26th. Interesting news on the food world order front coming out of places like India from thehindu.com. Feds claim U.S. food is safer. Meanwhile, FBI claims activists investigating factory farms can be tried as terrorists. Frito-Lay sued for labeling GMO snacks as all natural. Monsanto launches phony GMO coexistence protests. And San Francisco food truck rules don't hit the spot. That's from the San Francisco Examiner. But on the other side of the country, returning to the District of Criminals from the Washington Post and NBC Washington, food truck operators call D.C.'s parking meter crackdown unfair as D.C. cracks down on food truck parking.
Long before lunch lines begin.
Would you like mild, medium, or hot on there?
They're just like the best. We love them.
Food trucks scope out premium parking spots around D.C.
Are you doing the manicotti today or the truffle?
Location is critical, but comes at a price.
No matter how much it would be the meter, they're always eager to give tickets.
Brian Farrell runs Basil Time. He contacted the News4i team because he thinks he's being targeted by parking enforcement.
This is just all the tickets from the same officer.
He's not the only one. Every food vendor we talked to says they're getting tickets almost daily, mainly for parking at meters for more than 2 hours.
Being a small business is a struggle all on its own. You know, the last thing that we need is, you know, $1,000 a month. It's a lot of money.
The Department of Public Works enforces parking in D.C. and declined to go on camera, but confirmed it did start a two-person unit in October to address the increased presence of food trucks that violate parking regulations.
There's been cars parked right in front of me that have the meter expired, but they ignore that and specifically ticket us.
Josh Saltzman captured on his cell phone camera an officer writing his porkmobile a ticket as he got ready to leave his spot near Union Station.
Now she's done with all these vehicles and she's going to skip everything else.
Back in Metro Center Station, our cameras caught the same officer writing tickets for two-hour violations.
The red truck, the black truck, the silver truck, they all got tickets. Every truck on this block. But check this out. This is an illegal parking space. This is our car. We didn't get a ticket.
Neither did the cars parked on the same block, even though they had expired meters. DPW says the new unit is charged with ticketing all vehicles, not just food trucks. And those other cars might have paid by cell phone.
Regulations need to be enforced.
Andrew Klein with the city's restaurant association says food trucks are taking spaces from customers who would visit traditional food establishments.
Right now, the food trucks are operating under a fiction where they park at parking spots, which does not serve their interest because 2 hours does really not make a lot of sense for them. And also it does not take into account the other competing uses of public space.
Both sides say the city needs to do something because the current system isn't working. It's a food fight getting ready to boil over in the heart of D.C.
The remaining bits on foodworldorder.com. Again, something we discussed last night on Corbett Report Radio. Food and beverage companies the hedge fund managers love. Coca-Cola, Kraft, Pepsi, Campbell's, Dean Foods, Sara Lee, and Constellation. Yes, George Soros and their ilk. They don't just own media companies and brokerage houses. They own your food as well. So while we were discussing all the soda wars last night, it was reported recently from naturalnews.com, flame retardant chemical found in U.S. soft drinks, Mountain Dew, Fanta Orange, Squirt, some flavors of Gatorade and Powerade, contain BVO, brominated vegetable oil. Good God. Same ingredient used as flame retardant, slow down the chemical reactions which can cause fires. BVO weighs down the citrus flavoring so that it mixes with the other soda ingredients. Drink it up, yum. And we closed it on how Coca-Cola shaped the modern day Santa. They don't just poison our bodies, but they poison our minds as well, as the myths and the memes and the stories all become confused and blundered around. And as we noted before, how all of our high holy events seem to happen just as there are events happening in the sky. So we close all of it out with last week's posting of Food World Order on Corber Report Radio. So again, as I've kind of said, I haven't shaken all this out or figured out exactly what kind of turnaround I'm going to be able to have to get these videos posted up. However, James Corbett will have the audio of his entire show posted up within the hour of its completion. So go to CorbettReport.com and hit the radio tab, and you can get it. But we, again, will post them to our archive feed, which, again, is linked up on the top of the page. And, again, a huge thanks to our friend Morgan Lesko of WikiWorldOrder.com for hosting our newer, longer Food World Order videos on his unlimited YouTube channel at YouTube.com/WikiWorldOrder. I can't stress enough so many times. Twitter.com/MediaMonarchy. So many things going on there. So many things that we don't cover on the main show that happen in real time and in the moment. And we have added so many more kind of autopilot updates to cover all kinds of different worlds all around the clock. So we now have updates coming from Threat Level on the Cyberspace War tip, Food Safety News on the Food World Order tip, and again, of course, all the news on Holy Hexes from Cult News Network, everything from AllGov, everything from Corber Report. And we'll remind you again, all the latest Navigating Netflix and Pump Up the Volume Song of the Day, all that and so very much more, all available, again, on one site that hasn't yet sold out to multinational corporations, but I imagine that will come very soon, probably in 2012, and we'll have to shift and bob and weave again, my friends. As we glance back at the breaking news, Obama signs tax cut extension, leaves for Hawaii. That's 28 minutes ago from USA Today. And again, we see suicide bombs in Syria. We have a wave of earthquakes in New Zealand, which is how we rang in 2011. And there you have it, my friends. Watch for my Food World Order video coming this weekend. I've got my fingers crossed that I can put out our latest mixtape. It's going to be mixtape 14, the best of 2011, and just some of my favorite music of the year. It's going to be a short, sharp hour, and I hope to have that out within the next week. However, if that doesn't happen, we're still going to be here next Friday, December 30th, with episode 245, blowing out the rest of 2011. We implore you to donate. We implore you on so many levels to share this information, to verify this information for yourself, and again, to, especially here at the holidays, if you can, to donate. Your support helps keep Media Monarchy going and growing. And we're going to go out today with a track from my favorite band, and that's how we started last week's show, with a track from, originally from Halifax, Nova Scotia. They've relocated to the trendier climes of Toronto, Canada, but it's Sloan. And they recently released a benefit single. And we add the links for you, and it's on twitter.com/pumpupthevolume. And it's to benefit the Daily Bread Food Bank, local to their own situation. But if you don't like that, donate to your own local food bank. I don't have too many words of wisdom here as we approach Christmas, as we're here on Christmas Eve, December 23rd, 2011, as we end this episode 244. America is love. My name's James Evan Pilato, your host and webmaster of the site and show MediaMonarchy.com. Reminding you, as always, my friends, don't hate the media, become the media. Take care and have a happy holiday.
On the first day of Christmas, my true love gave to me a partridge in a pear tree. On the second day of Christmas, my true love gave to me two turtle doves and a partridge in a pear tree. On the third day of Christmas, Christmas my true love gave to me. Three French hens,
two turtle doves,
and a partridge in a pear tree. On the fourth day of Christmas my true love gave to me. Four calling birds,
three French hens,
two turtle doves,
and a partridge in a pear tree.
On the fifth day of Christmas my true love gave to me.
Five golden rings,
four calling birds,
three French hens,
two turtle doves,
and a partridge in a pear tree.
On the sixth day of Christmas my true love gave to me. Six geese a-laying,
five golden rings,
four calling birds,
three French hens,
two turtle doves,
and a partridge in a pear tree.
On the seventh day of Christmas my true love gave to me. Seven swans a-swimming,
six geese a-laying,
five golden rings,
four calling birds,
three French hens,
two turtle doves,
and a partridge in a pear tree. On the eighth day of Christmas my true love gave to me. Eight maids a-milking,
seven swans a-swimming,
six geese a-laying,
five golden rings,
four calling birds,
three French hens,
two turtle doves,
and a partridge in a pear tree.
On the ninth day of Christmas my true love gave to me. Nine pipers piping,
eight maids a-milking,
seven swans a-swimming,
six geese a-laying,
five golden rings,
four calling birds,
three French hens,
two turtle doves,
and a partridge in a pear tree.
On the tenth day of Christmas my true love gave to me.
Ten ladies dancing,
nine pipers piping,
eight maids a-milking,
seven swans a-swimming,
six geese a-laying,
five golden rings,
four calling birds,
three French hens,
two turtle doves,
and a partridge in a pear tree.
On the 11th day of Christmas my true love gave to me.
11 lords a-leaping,
10 ladies dancing,
9 pipers piping,
8 maids a-milking,
7 swans a-swimming,
6 geese a-laying,
5 golden rings,
4 calling birds,
3 French hens,
2 turtle doves,
and a partridge in a pear tree.
On the 12th day of Christmas my true love gave to me.
12 drummers drumming,
11 lords a-leaping,
10 ladies dancing,
9 pipers piping,
8 maids a-milking,
7 swans a-swimming,
6 geese a-laying,
5 golden rings,
4 calling birds,
3 French hens,
2 turtle doves,
and a partridge in a pear tree.
MediaMonarchy.com is your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. Featuring weekly radio shows on the Portland Radio Authority, PRAradio.org, the New World Network video series with CorbettReport.com, plus special interview episodes, B-sides, mixtapes, and so much more. Send news tips to MediaMonarchy@gmail.com. You can make a donation, or mail media to the Monarchy, at P.O. Box 12165, Portland, Oregon, 97212. Thanks to all the internet and community radio stations who broadcast these shows, and most of all, thanks to you. Remember, don't hate the media, become the media.
Whether you went on with the diary, or whether you did not go on with it, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.